Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is a More Than Just Podcast production.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 355 of the More Than Just Code podcast. My name is Tim Mitra. I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by Jaime Lopez Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
And I'm also joined by Mark Rubin down in San Jose, California. Alrighty. So yeah, we've been away for a bit. I should mention too that this episode is being brought to you, fine folks, by Runway or Runway.team. So we'll talk about them in a bit. Yeah, so we have some follow-up items from my last episode with George. The first one is we were talking about, I don't know if you guys were following along, but we talked about AI and how the, what's the name of the tool that's bringing in going out and scraping in the artworks and turning people's images or avatars, creating avatars for people?
Is it Stable Diffusion?
Stable Diffusion. Did I talk about this on the last show? I mean, I don't recall. Anyway, I found this post
probably
on...
Probably not More Than Just Code, but podcast, I think it came up from the artistic side and not the technology side.
Yeah.
So it's kind of blends or sits in between both worlds.
Yeah, right. It was because of the Disney connection I brought it in. Yeah, so this article or this post that was on Mastodon was pretty funny. It's artists are now taking back the they're fighting back by, rather than complaining or trying to fight against the individual AI companies or how would they possibly fight back? They're using AI to create images of Disney and Mario and Spider-Man, like Disney or Mickey Mouse with a machine gun kind of thing. To sort of, play with, to get the big boys to fight the fight for them rather than try and go after individual people creating this stuff. So it's kind of funny that they're using the big companies to try and fight that stuff. And actually, just I think I don't have a link. I'll put a link in the show notes here, but I don't have a link here on the notes that there's a class action lawsuit started by artists in the United States to go after their artwork being used, potentially being used in these Stable Diffusion pieces of work, right? Artworks. So that's kind of cool. The other piece that's sort of a follow-up from a long time back here, every time Apple updates the Apple design resources, I always like to point out that they've been, tuned up or brought up to date. A couple of minor things they did in January was they updated the Photoshop library for creating production templates for like icons and things like that. But what I thought was interesting, and they've added a keynote to the iOS 16 section where you can now create mockups for your apps using Keynote, which is kind of cool. I haven't tried it out myself, but that's a pretty interesting use of an everyday tool that people would have at their disposal, right? Since we all have Keynote for free anyway, right? Pretty much. Keynote's free, right? Is it these days?
Yeah,
it is. So. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, so that's kind of cool.
Cool. I'm sort of surprised they don't have anything for Figma here. It seems to be Figma is the
Figma, yeah, that's true, one. Yeah.
Yeah, they have Sketch and Photoshop.
Yeah, there was a joke on socials the other day saying, actually just yesterday, saying, show how old you are by telling us what your design tool you used first. And like half of the room said Figma.
Yeah.
And then one guy says Sketch. He's the old guy in the crowd, right? Of course, I had to throw in that I started with Illustrator 88 back in 1988. But yeah, that's beside the point.
What was the one in the 90s?
Freehand?
No, it wasn't that one. It was really good because it was much better at doing 3D stuff than some of the other tools, but it's gone now. It's long gone.
You mean like the Macromedia stuff? Or
no, it Flash? Competed with Macromedia, as I recall.
Really?
Well, it wasn't.
You mean like just 3D, 3D tool. Like 3D texting and stuff like that? Like,
yeah, if you want to make a drawing and have it like, you know, render, stretch it out to make it look like 3D, pseudo 3D, not real 3D, but
yeah, I know what you mean.
But
yeah,
it was really good for that. I can't remember. I'll have to.
Wasn't like After Effects or anything like that.
No. Okay.
Well, I did the Spotcast. It has 3D type in it, but I did that by hand in Photoshop. So, because I'm old school. By hand in Photoshop, that's kind of an ironic way to say it too. It's like the flat earth people, you know, say they have membership all around the globe, but I'll let that sink in for a minute. I just want to get your opinions because we haven't been on the show since all this Stable Diffusion and ChatGPT came out. And I just want to get a sort of a, you know, idea what you guys are thinking about ChatGPT. I assume you've seen some of the code samples that's been created, and you can get it to write you an essay and that kind of stuff.
I don't have a real strong opinion on it. I mean, I think it's pretty cool. It actually works remarkably well for a lot of things, for generating text. I've never seen code that it generated. I've never looked at that. I mean, it's sort of not surprising that it's gotten to this point, right? It's, natural language processing has come an enormously long way. So you just couple that with some neural networks under the hood and you got it, right? So I'm not surprised. It's kind of cool. Is it going to change the world? Maybe. I don't know.
Well, it's interesting. Like, I mean, I've played around with it a bit for writing code, and I know that when you write code with the tool, you know, you'll ask it to build you a login screen or something like that, or you know, deal with some kind of thing. It'll do like sort of the basic approach, right? And if you want to tune it, you have to tell it, okay, let's do it with this. And like, it's almost like you have to instruct it to get a little bit more complicated or get more complex or handle, you know, more sophisticated things before it'll start writing you a really sophisticated piece of programming, right? It's cool. I've seen it do Python. I've seen it do Swift. You know, I've tried it out with Swift a few times, and there's a lot of, you know, videos online from people trying it out. But one interesting thing I saw just yesterday again was somebody had taken some Swift code that they had written and passed it into ChatGPT and said, write the comments for what this code is doing. And it added the comments into the block to show where, what the actual parts of the, you know, what the for loop was doing and what the, you know, general idea behind the method was, right? And that was kind of, that's interesting
cool.
use of it.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah.
So I want to do the ad read thing so we can talk about our sponsor. Runway is a platform that helps your mobile team automate and collaborate on app releases. Top mobile teams are using Runway to offload manual busy work and get on the same page during release cycles, increasing app quality and allowing the team to get back on to building great apps. By integrating all the tools you already use, Runway gives your entire mobile team a single source of truth. That's one place to review and sign off on work, automate releases end-to-end, track release health and stability, and get a complete overview of how your team is performing from release to release. Runway's at-a-glance transparency and helpful alerting makes mobile release process smoother and easier to manage, from kickoff to submission to release and everything in between. Put your release train on autopilot and take the guesswork out of shipping updates so your team can get their work into the user's hands more quickly and confidently. More Than Just Coder listeners can get an extended trial of Runway's powerful business plan. To get started, head to runway.team/mtjc. And that's cool. So I took this for a test drive last month, And, you know, as we work at where I work currently, we use a lot of the tools that you can integrate into the tool. Like we use Bitrise for our CI/CD, and I know we have Sentry for monitoring, and, you know, we use GitHub. And what else do we have in here that we integrate with? We use Mixpanel and Google Analytics for Android folks. We use, you know, feature flags with Optimizely, and as well Bitrise. And so when you go into the runway control panel, you see all these various things, and you connect all your accounts, including your Apple account and your Testflight account. And then basically when you do a build or when you do a release, it automates all these different processes, runs through to, you know, sends errors to Sentry so you can follow up on them and that kind of stuff. And kind of a cool little one sort of, and Jaime was mentioning earlier, like it's kind of a one control panel place to sort of set up all the things. And you can opt in and out of different things. Like if your QA is using TestRail, for example, you can use TestRail, right? And you can integrate with things like Jira and Slack and stuff like that, so that you can have the automated notifications and ticket managing and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I was thinking about it as sort of an analogy to like Slack. So a lot of folks think that like Salesforce bought Slack for something like $27 billion because it's a neat chat app with cool emoji. And I'm sure that some tiny sliver of that, but really, I think the reason Slack was worth so much as an acquisition target was because it's increasingly like the way that you run your operations of your business. And I think that this tool certainly feels a lot like that too, looking at all the sort of integrations that it does with, you know, with Slack, with GitHub or GitLab, with Bitrise, with, you know, other things like Jira or
Google Test, Google Play. Yeah.
Yeah. So it increasingly becomes an easy way to answer sort of self-service all the questions that people might have. Compliance may want to know, hey, did we get, you know, the new EULA agreement in there? And they can look and say, oh, yes, there it is. Cool. Compliance signs off on its part without somebody having to be the release manager or release marshal and like go rounding up all the cats, right? And you can have, from what I see here in their material, like things like, oh, the partial rollout has some interesting bugs that came up. All right, cool. Bugsnag is grabbing stuff, and we're trying to see, does this hit thresholds that should roll back the release and just automate away a lot of the things that you would have to spend a lot of time on. And especially when you get to a larger team, it becomes a lot more problematic to keep that all in sync.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Like Sentry, Bugsnag, Firebase is also integrated into it as well. Like you can integrate into it. So it's cool. Like it's like I said, we use a lot of these tools. I was fortunate to join the team, and a lot of the stuff, all this automation has already been configured. But, you know, if I was starting from scratch, it would be a great place to sort of give it a shot. So anyway, like I think the standard trial is a month for free, but as you can see, they're giving our listeners an extended trial. So, you know, if you're interested in looking into what it will do for you, give it a shot. You know, sign up, get a trial going. Anyway, the reason why we got together today is Apple did another one of their sort of stealthy, we were calling it a keynote, doing air quotes, yesterday to introduce the new Mac, M2 Pro and M2 Max processors, which are, they had the M2 out last year, last fall, and they put it into the MacBook Air, and they put it into the MacBook 13 Pro, and so now they've got the Mac Mini. I read something the other day that the Mac Mini hasn't really been updated in a while, but I thought the Mac Mini was part of the first M1s as well. But
I have one of those.
Yeah, so the M2 Pro and M2 Maxes are now available in the Mac Mini configuration, and as well, they also brought out the new MacBook Pro 14 and 16s. So you have an M1. I had the test one that was I think it wasn't using an M1 chip. It was an Apple Silicon ASIC A13, I think, when they first announced the Apple Silicon chips for Macs. So if you have an M1, what do you think about it?
Well, I've been using it since I got it, which has now been at least a couple of years now, and it works fine. Truth is, I don't do a lot of heavy-duty stuff on my home machine these days. You know, I have a work machine, which is an M1 Max laptop. for work stuff. So I use it really just for surfing the web and reading email. That's about it. But it's perfectly fine for that. Works great. Boots up fast. Still, I still get a couple of weird little glitchy things that happen every once in a while. Like I've always had problems. Like I use a, as you know, I use a Bluetooth keyboard and trackpad. And it's been doing this since day one. Every once in a while, and I don't know what the pattern is, but every once in a while, just I won't be able to click on the trackpad. It just stops. I can you know move around. I can scan with the move the cursor around, so it's detecting things and it's connected, but it just doesn't register taps or clicks or anything. And the only way I can fix that is to reboot.
Really? Like there's no like I guess the Bluetooth just shuts down or whatever, right? Like
yeah. Yeah. Well, no, I mean, the Bluetooth is okay because I can pan around. I can move the cursor.
Oh, okay. Right.
It just doesn't register taps or clicks. Don't know what that is.
Yeah, it's weird. I kind of have a similar thing happening on my phone sometimes. Like I'll go to tap something and it just kind of sits there for a minute. It's almost like there's something blocking, a process blocking or something like that, eh? Like,
yeah.
Yeah. And Jaime, are you using silicone these days or?
No, I'm still hanging on to the Intel MacBook Pro that I have. But these are, these are looking pretty interesting. Like they got the weird spec bump treatment, and I guess on paper they are. But this just helps the proliferation of the M2 and all of Apple Silicon. Where I think is it just the Mac Pro that's left as the outlier?
Yeah, actually, I think it's the only Intel machine on right now, right? The cheese grater one you're talking about.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. It's funny. Greg and I saw the new studio. What's it called? I think it's Mac Studio. What do they call the new one with the little heatsink on the back? Greg and I went to the Apple Store here in Toronto when he was here for the holidays. All right. Let's talk about the M2 and the M2 Pro, and then we'll dig into the Mini as it got both of these in there. So Apple in there, they did a little sort of keynote presentation. They didn't talk much about, and they tend not to do this about all the sort of significant things in it. But this, actually, I'm just looking at the M2. So the M2 is in the, is M2 in the Mini?
I think so.
I've got a couple of shots.
No, the M2 Pro is in the Mini, isn't it?
Oh, yes, you're right. I'm just kind of scrubbing through the YouTube.
So I've got a screen here for the M2, so let's talk about that real quick. So that's up to 24 gigabytes of memory. It gets the high performance media engine. I'm reading off the slide I sent you guys yesterday. 40% faster neural engine, faster than what? I don't know. Guess the M1, I guess. It's funny that they compared all their stats against the M1. 15.8 trillion operations per second, 16-core neural engine, 8-core CPU, and up to 10-core GPU, giving it 18% faster CPU, 35% faster GPU, 50% more memory bandwidth, 100 gigabits per second memory bandwidth, and 20 billion transistors, right? And can support a 6K external display, which is the high res, the pro high res, right? Or the XDR. But the M2, I just don't know what it supports. Thunderbolt 4. This one's up to 32 gigs of memory, 20% faster CPU, and 30% faster GPU, 12 core CPU, 19, and the video, they explain that 8 of those cores are sort of main ones, and then there's a faster, I forget what they call the faster cores that are in the CPU. They've got 4 of those in there, making a total of 12. A 19-core GPU, again, the 5-nanometer technology, which we talk about all the time. And then the Max kicks it up to 96 gigabytes of memory. This is quite a significant amount of memory it handles. 12-core GPU, 38-core GPU, 400 gigabits per second memory bandwidth. I assume that's pretty quick, eh, Mark? And 67 billion transistors. So quite a hefty jump in terms of capability and speed, right?
But how much faster does it really feel when you use it? That's a real question. These are just numbers, you know, honestly.
No, I know. And it's like, you know, the little commercial they showed in the video is just like, it's so fast, I can scrub like in real time. And it's hard to say what you really compare these things to, right?
I guess if you're rendering, you know, the game engine kind of stuff, it might make a difference, right? Or video or high res video, that kind of stuff. But I mean, supporting up to 8, like the Mini, as an example, says it can support up to 8K video through HDMI, which is pretty impressive, right? Can support up to 3 displays. Now, I think the one you, Mark, have now, do you know how many monitors it'll support off the top of your head?
Wasn't there something about it? It could only support one external monitor?
Yeah, I recall that being, that was the case with the developer machine, right? It only supported one.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that was a limit of the M1.
Yeah, I think so. I haven't tried plugging in more than one monitor, so I don't really know.
Yeah, and looking at the back of the Mini, it looks like it still has 4 Thunderbolt ports, the USB-C ports. It has Ethernet built in, which is nice, and HDMI, and it also has 2 USB-A ports, I guess. You know,
it's funny. It has 4 USB-C ports? That's an improvement. Oh, 2.
Oh, sorry, USB-C, okay. 4 Thunderbolt ports.
Oh, that's nice. I've only got 2 on mine. I've got 2 USB-C and 2 USB-A.
Right, and then you have
an HDMI, which can be kind of limiting.
Do you have optical out on that? Well, I guess it wouldn't matter if you have optical on that one. But you do have HDMI, right?
I'm trying to feel around in the back of it. Here,
it's where your monitor is.
It's not a laptop. It's hard to turn around.
Yeah.
Especially
when you're on the show.
I think I've got HDMI, yeah. I think so.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty sure you do, because I recall running my Mini off my TV in my family room here. Yeah, so quite an impressive little piece of machinery. I mean, especially if you're going to use it for a build machine or something like that, right? And you can put the M2 Pro. Well, sorry, this one, the Mini can come with the M2. That's why I had the M2 slide. Mini can come with M2 or M2 Pro, right? It doesn't do the Max. The Max is going to go into the 14 and 16.
Right. That's a high-end one.
Yeah. Yeah. And what do you think, Kami?
I mean, it seems pretty snazzy. I'm still kind of weirded out by the 19-core GPU. So the uneven number is weird that it's not 18 and it's not 20. I don't know what sort of binning practices go into this sort of thing, but I'm sure there's a good reason that it's an uneven number. It's an odd number.
Yeah, it's weird looking at, I guess maybe it been how the chip laid out, because if you look at the little graphic they've got here, it's literally like, it's like 10 GPUs on the top row and then 9 on the bottom row. Maybe it just sort of bumped into the way they laid out the chip, you know?
I feel like the M2 Max answers my question, even though it's still kind of a very strange number. So by comparison, the M2 Max has up to a 38-core GPU. So that would be precisely double the 19. It's still kind of a strange number. So I guess that's how that ends up working.
Yeah, you know, this is weird. I'm looking at this. So you know where I was talking about there's too many iPads to choose from? There are now too many Macs to choose from. Like, I'm just looking at I went to the comparison page, and if you click on the little pull-down menu, you've got MacBook Air M2, MacBook Air M1, MacBook Pro 13 M2, MacBook 14 M2 Pro and M2 Max, and you've got the MacBook Pro 16 M2 Pro, M2 Max. Then you've got desktop machines, which are the iMac M1 with 2 ports, iMac M1 with 4 ports, a Mac Mini M2 or M2 Pro, the Mac Studio, which is M1 Max or M1 Ultra. We forgot about the Studio's still M1s, right? Not M2s. And the Mac Pro Intel, which we talked about. And then there's more laptops on top of that. There's like a couple of Intel machines. Is this current? This can't be current machine.
No, where are you looking? I'm looking at Apple's website. I don't see any of that.
If you go to the comparison page, right? You know, if you go to compare Mac models, go to under Mac and then go to compare Mac models.
Yeah.
And if you click on the one, you got the 3 Macs across the top, and if you click on the pull down menu at the top, or I mean, where you select the models you want to compare.
I'm still looking for the.
So they have the current Macs are the 5 or the current laptops are the 5 that I mentioned, and then there's 5 current desktops, and then they've got more, I guess, more Macs in there for comparison basis, right?
Oh, I see it now. Okay.
Oh, you do?
Well,
I'll share it so Jaime can see.
Yeah. See all models. Okay.
So these are the 5 current laptops, right? And then those are the 5 current desktops. But then they've got all these other, I guess these other, these are recently, you would have recently purchased some of these devices, right? So which one do you have now currently, Jaime? You have a 14 or a 16?
Pull up about this Mac. About this Mac says, oh, it looks different in Ventura. The MacBook Pro 16-inch from 2019.
But that's with an Intel?
Yes, it's running a 2.6 gigahertz 6-core Intel Core i7.
Yeah, interesting. Oh, so there's a, yeah, the MacBook Pro 16, is it 2019 you said?
2019, that's probably mine. That,
yeah,
you can,
okay,
buy.
So we can make a comparison between Jaime's lame computer and the new one.
About to go to a farm upstate kind of computer, right?
Yeah, there's your comparison there. So, yeah, but you want to see the 19 one, that's the one that really...
Wait, don't compare to the 16-inch M1 Pro, that's not the current one, is it?
No, oh, sorry, yeah, you're right, M2. Yeah, so you got your lowly Core i9 Intel processor. Remember when those were like the hottest thing on the planet? You have a separate GPU, like a separate chip, right?
Mm-hmm.
You only get 11 hours battery life. How do you live with that? Huh?
It could go up to 96 gigs on the RAM. Do you see that?
And you can only
64
go to 64,
is what, right? Mine has. Yeah. And then it looks like this maxes out at 96. Up to 8 terabytes of storage. So looking at this here, now granted, my current laptop, you know, has had wear and tear on the battery, so it's not going to get that 11 hours that they're talking about.
I don't think it ever got 11 hours, to be honest with you.
If it was, you know, brand spanking new, it hypothetically doubled the battery life there in the way that they're testing this. So that's pretty neat.
But you have a touch bar too, right? Right?
I do have a touch bar, that's right.
Yeah.
So that reduces the comparison value for your machine then, Jaime.
Depends on your opinion. That's like your opinion, man.
That is my opinion, yes.
Yeah. No, I happen to like the touch bar. I miss it on my my device. Mind you, it's funny. As much as I miss it, I don't really miss it. You know, like I still have it. Carol's machine still has the touch bar, right? But if I really feel I need to use it.
Just wait for the new touchscreen Macs that are rumored.
We'll see. We'll see how tired my arm will be, according to Steve Jobs, right? I was in the Best Buy at Christmas time, and I noticed that the 13-inch M2, right? The 13-inch Pro M2 still has a track bar. It only has two ports on one side, but it still has a track bar. It's the only Mac out there right now that has a track bar.
And it's an M2?
And it's an M2.
Wow.
It just updated, few months ago, right? In the fall. Huh. Yeah, weird, eh? Like the M1 Air and the MacBook Air is now an M2, and the MacBook Pro 13 is also an M2. It's like sort of a consumer level pro machine. You know, it's kind of a weird device because it sits in that sort of, and it has a fan too, whereas the Air doesn't have a fan, right? Huh. I'm watching a video about a guy putting in thermal pads inside an Air to dissipate some of the heat on the bottom case, you know, because apparently the processor throttles when it gets hot, you know. Huh. Yeah, so if you use the, you know, the thermal shielding or thermal, I don't know, it's like a pad or whatever.
Yeah, it's a heat sink basically.
It just transfers it to the bottom case, and then the device can run faster or longer, kind of thing, I guess. Let's dig into the MacBook Pros. The 14 and the 16, right? So we've got HDMI port. Again, Thunderbolt. I think these only have 3 Thunderbolts. Like my 16-inch only has 3. It has the MagSafe, right? And the Thunderbolt. And to be honest with you, like, I use the MagSafe here on my desk, but when I'm traveling, I don't take the MagSafe charger with me. I just bring a regular USB, you know, charger. USB-C charger, right? Yeah, so because you can charge the Mac from any USB port, right? USB-C port, so... Yeah. Wait, what do you have for work, Mark? Is it a 16-inch?
I have a 16-inch Max, M1 Max.
Yeah. Yeah, same as me.
I bring the MagSafe with me. I mean, as a USB charger, any lighter weight.
I bought myself Anchor makes one, and I bought a small one off of Amazon, and it's basically got two USB-Cs. It's a 65-watt charger, uh-huh. Two USB-Cs and a USB-A, so I can charge all the things when I'm traveling, right?
Okay, yeah.
I mean, like, you know, if you've got more than one thing plugged in, obviously it doesn't crank out 65 watts per port, but still, it's strong enough to charge my Mac, and my iPad, because I've also got the Intel iPad, right? Just USB-C as well. So that's cool. And plus now I've got the, you know, the watch and the, like, I've got the Ultra Watch much. I don't know if I told you that, Mark, but I also, everything's USB-C pretty much. On this
except your iPhone.
Of the house. Except my iPhone. Well, it uses MagSafe, and the MagSafe is USB-C, right?
Well, yeah, and you could get a USB-C to Lightning cable if you wanted to, but it's...
Yeah, I've got those too, yeah. Yeah, it's funny, like, you know, you remember the AirPower? Carol and I both got the new charger thing that has, like, it has, like, a watch, pops up for the watch, and then it's also got a MagSafe on it, and it plugs in with a Lightning cable. This is for an Apple product. And it basically charges those two. The only thing it doesn't charge is if I had AirPods, which I don't have, right? So, but it's pretty much, I guess, the equivalent of the AirPower. Like, the AirPower was supposed to be able to charge no matter where you put things down, right? Wasn't that the magic behind it?
Yeah, it was a giant pad. You just put stuff down on top of it, and it would charge it. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So one thing I thought was cool about this the 14-inch and the 16-inch is they both have XDR displays now, right? I had heard a couple of days ago, last week or so, that somebody was thinking it might be a mini OLED or a mini LED on these devices, but these are Liquid Retina Display XDR, so the same quality as the big Pro monitor, right?
Hmm.
The ones they came out with last year and the Pro Display XDR. What's XDR? Extended Dynamic Range? Is that what that stands for?
I think you nailed it. I think that's what it is.
Yeah. And studio quality microphone.
Yeah, I think the newer laptops ended up getting a better camera after people complaining for such a long time, right? And I think they got better microphones too. I didn't see in this video covering the new laptops. I don't remember specifically what, if anything, they said, but wouldn't surprise me that they would use the same better hardware across the board for their laptops.
Yeah, they had, because I know that on the iMacs, they came up with better cameras, right? Because of the whole working from home thing, right? That was one of the things we talked about last time, right? When we covered that camera, here you go. 1080p FaceTime HD camera. Okay, let me pull up one of the iMacs here so we can see, compare it to that in the fancy schmancy iMacs. But look, they only have M1s. How lame is that? Yeah, so same camera that went into the new iMacs. Yeah, you're right. Tell me about that. And built-in Dolby Atmos and spatial audio with dynamic head tracking. Well, when using AirPods, what? Why would that matter? That's weird, eh? Why would spatial audio with dynamic head tracking when using AirPods third generation matter when you're using a laptop? I guess it's got some sort of way of telling where your head is relative to the screen.
Yeah, I think it's thinking? Using one of those. Is it? U1, W1 chips?
Yes, it's a U something chip. Yeah, you're right. That was in the spec I saw somewhere. And it's also got the Wi-Fi 6E, which is new, right? And I heard that, I was reading somewhere that Wi-Fi 6E, not every application will support that protocol. Had you heard that? It's all news to you guys, right?
If it's Wi-Fi, why should the application have anything to do with it? That's at the...
I don't know. That's just one of the things I read. I could go back and read the article and see, but...
That sounds a little strange. I mean, anything's possible, but that sounds a little weird.
Yeah. That looks pretty cool. Oh, 8 terabyte SSD drive there, Jaime. How about that? You could have all your Pokemons in one place and download all those streaming shows you're watching, right?
I don't recall what I have. I think I have a 1 terabyte. Is that what I've got?
Yeah, I bought a 2 and regretted it. I have a 1 in my Air now.
Yeah, one terabyte here.
So yeah, so the power supply is a 67-watt USB-C on the... On the 14, it's 140-watt USB-C power adapter on the 16-inch. Interesting. You can heat up your coffee with that real quick. So I guess, you know, typical go around the table. Are you looking to upgrade your Mac Mini, Mark, to the M2 Pro Mac Ultra?
You know, that's an interesting question. I don't remember, but we talked about this when I first got the Mac Mini, that my strategy was to get a Mac Mini when they first came out, so I could get an M1 chip and then hold on to it until the laptops came out. And then I would get a laptop because I was replacing a laptop. Once I got the laptop, then I just used the mini as a server or something like that. And the pandemic happened and I pretty much never had a need to take a laptop and go anywhere. So, So I'm still using that Mac Mini. So now the question is, well, first of all, do I need to update? I'm not actually 100% sure I need to update at this point. But if I did, would I go for a laptop again or would I go for another Mini? It's a good question. I don't know. I don't really have a lot of need for a laptop these days.
Yeah, but if you were like going, if you wanted to go work in a coffee shop or go for a burrito or something like that, like, wouldn't it be nice to have? Would you take your laptop, or you just wouldn't take your laptop to work?
Take my laptop. Even when I travel these days, I don't take my laptop because I generally just take an iPad, and I can't write code, obviously. I can't do real work, but if I'm traveling for business, then that's one thing. Yeah, but if I'm just traveling for personal stuff, I don't bring my laptop. I just bring an iPad. So yeah, it's a good question.
How about you, Jaime? Are you ready to make the jump, or you don't need a laptop either these days?
I don't need a laptop at the moment. And the nice thing is that, you know, there's fewer occasions of people complaining about specific developer tools not working. I think the vast majority of that is in the rearview mirror for people jumping over Apple Silicon. So I think, as I probably said when the first Silicon Macs came out, I said, well, I can afford to wait it out for Father Time to win, where I eventually just gracefully upgrade to a new Apple M whatever that's available that year, and all my developer tools work without any messing around with anything.
One thing to consider, this is not a big deal for me, but it might be for you, Jaime, or maybe for others, is that apparently, I didn't even think of this, but apparently a lot of games, when the Macs were on the Intel chip, it was very easy to just take the Windows version of the game and port it over because it was all running on the same chip, and a lot of the developer tools just worked naturally. And it was very, you know, like I said, it was very easy to port. But now that we're on the M1, they have to go back to running it in some kind of, unless they rewrite the code, they have to run it in some kind of emulator mode. They have to run it in, what was it, Rosetta or something. And so even with the super fast Apple Silicon, you don't necessarily get get as good gaming performance as you might have on an older generation Intel. Have you heard about this?
I haven't, and I've migrated to mostly a combo of games that, you know, eventually made their way to the Mac and are natively mm-hmm. running on the laptop, or to streaming services that bypass all of that at the expense of, you know, if your internet's bad, you're going to have a bad time. But I have not, unfortunately, kept up to date with what you're talking about.
Hmm. Okay, but speaking of real-time follow-up, Mark, I found the article I was talking about, and I'm just looking at it here, and there's a post here that says, you know, changes are needed in Mac OS and its framework for third-party apps that take advantage of the new 6E Wi-Fi interface. It says, I'm hoping Apple will make those changes soon. So it doesn't specifically say what apps per se, but I guess it's ones that tap into the...
And it doesn't say...
Hold on. Framework.
Don't scroll so fast. I'm trying to read what you have here.
How about that Last of Us show, Jaime?
Oh, yeah. Pretty good. Definitely a reason to continue your HBO Max subscription if you've still got it.
Wait, what show are you talking about?
The Last of Us just started.
Oh.
So I went and downloaded the game for PS4. And then, of course, I had no room on my drive, so I had to upgrade the drive inside my PS4. And then it took 5 hours to download the game. It was like, you know... Took me like a day just to get to play.
What are you guys talking about? What game?
The Last of Us. The Last of Us TV show is based on a game called The Last of Us from 2014.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So let's get back to the matter in hand.
I can't really get anything out of this article, I guess that, you know, you need to have some kind of some different API in order to get access to the 6C.
The guy from Intuibits, the co-founder and developer, Adrian Grandos,
says that, you know, he has a Wi-Fi advantage of that.
He's got the Wi-Fi Explorer app, which is basically something that checks your local machine, local network, right? So his specific tool is for networking, right, or for examining your networking. So that may be, he may be finding that his current execution or implementation isn't savvy with the new chips, new Wi-Fi chip. Yeah, I mean, like an effect Photoshop per se, right? Or, you know, Xcode, let's say, like that.
Right. So the question then is, if you are just making a NS session, right, NS URL session call in the normal way, does that work with this new Wi-Fi? I would think it would have to, right? But maybe what he's, as he said, what he's talking about, if he has a like a network analysis tool, he might be using some real low level under the hood APIs that get special info that just isn't available because there isn't no API for it yet. And that's different than some application just making a standard network call through iOS or, well, not iOS, but Mac OS, and piping through the network layer. Yeah. I don't know. Can't really tell from that article, at least. Interesting question though.
Yeah. I'm going to share my screen here. Sorry, I just pulled up Apple's press announcement about the new chips to see if we can glean anything significant from there. Because like I said, the keynote thing was very sort of high level, didn't really delve into too much, right? So these are the Apple system on the chip, Apple Silicon designs, right? They're just, you know, saying more GPU, more memory, more unified memory. And I assume these are going to all be the same sort of idea where you the configuration you buy is a configuration you live with until you buy a new Mac, right?
Oh, for sure. For sure.
Yeah. I just flipped through the three configurations.
Yeah, I mean, especially given that the chips aren't even the same shape, right? It's not likely that you could just, if you wanted to upgrade, and get your soldering iron out and unsolder the chip drop a new one in. You can't do that anymore. No more of the days where you could if you had an old Mac and you wanted to extend the lifetime for another couple of years, you could just order an upgraded chip and just pop it in. I'm sure you did that, Tim, back in the day.
Well, I did do, I used to use, I think the PowerPC days, right? When they went to, when G3 came out, I think you could add if you had a 6100, you could add a newer, like from the company newer tech.
Exactly.
I think I have one, I have a G3 board and I plug it into that Mac and then suddenly it's a G3, right?
It was OWC, wasn't it? One World Computing. They owned newer tech.
Oh, they own them now. Yeah. Did they own them back then?
I don't.
I think they bought them. I know they own them now, right? Because you can still buy some of that stuff from them on the OWC site, right? You can still buy some of that product. I thought they went out of business. Here's an interesting metric here. Apple's press announcement, they've got code compiling in Xcode as a metric between the machines. So it's the M2 Pro on the 16-inch is 2.5 times faster than Jaime's Core i9 MacBook Pro, and it's 25% faster than the M1 Pro.
Yeah. So that's good, and that's nice and all, but is 25% faster enough to really make a difference? You know, when our builds, well, you know, I guess it depends how long your builds are. But if you're using this for like a CI machine where it's constantly churning through builds, then yeah, maybe that makes sense. But if you're just a developer sitting at your own machine, it's still annoying to wait instead of, you know, 4 minutes to wait 3 minutes for a build to finish.
And also when Jaime's trying to decide between using a for loop and a for each, is this going to make him 2.5% faster? 2.5 times faster, I should say? No. Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, yeah, I think for a build machine, it would make a difference in terms of, or if building was what you're doing, you know, all the time, that would make a huge difference. And we do notice that. I mean, like, you know, I know that with when I was at TD Bank, we had, you know, a bunch of M1 mini or minis that we used, and then when we switched to the M1s, we got significantly more throughput. Like what would take half an hour would take like 20 minutes now instead of. It wasn't like I couldn't really put a met, like say specifically 25%, but it was definitely faster.
Yeah.
So much so that it made sense to make the investment. Right?
Yeah. But yeah, for your own machine, if it's long enough that it interrupts what you're working on, then a 25% improvement on that doesn't really help that much, because it's once you're distracted, once you're taken out of the context, it sort of doesn't matter, unfortunately. Now, if it's 2x, that's a difference. Yeah, and that's a different story.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is between, like, according to between Apple, Jaime's machine. Between Jaime's machine. Yeah. Jaime is so much slower than everything else, right? That's why it's taking so long to respond to us today.
That's why.
Yeah.
It's the confluence of having not the latest Wi-Fi spec plus, you know, Zoom and everything else just chewing up my CPU and GPU.
Plus the internet and all the tubes that are on the internet, stuff like that.
Yeah. Right. It does make me wonder, you know, so they've got the M2 with the Max and stuff, if they're going to end up with an Ultra version. I think when the M1 Ultra came out, I had proposed that it was like duct taping two Maxes together.
If I literally was, yeah, that definitely was. It was the two of them. They just didn't bother cutting them apart or something like that, right? Or they designed it with the bus that they just, if they didn't cut it, it would, two chips together would act as one kind of thing. That's what made the Ultra, and it was twice as wide. You're right. So this is like the Pro and the Max here are two separate chip designs, right? Specifically, one made to be better than the previous, right? Too bad we didn't have a chip expert on the show.
Well, what's the question, Tim?
No, I was just saying, like, we were just talking about the architecture of the Ultra. Jaime had reminded me that it was like a Siamese twin, right? Because they had that Siamese connection in the middle, and they just didn't bother cutting the board apart. And since the two were connected, they acted as one big giant chip, right? Whereas these Ultras, the Max and the Pro are designed as separately different. They're from the layout different, right?
Right. Well, remember, the way they manufacture these things is these things are all on the surface of a wafer.
Yeah, exactly.
And so you get a whole grid of chips in every case. So you can't easily, well, I mean, you could in theory do this, but you wouldn't put like a M1 regular M1 and an M1 Max or an M1 Pro on the same wafer because the way these things work is there's a machine called a stepper, which, you know, patterns it in one spot, then it moves to the next spot, moves to the next spot.
Yeah.
So what you could do is if you want to have two copies of the same thing as one thing, it's still just doing that same stepping. And there's a space in between each instance of the thing that you pattern where you normally just cut up the wafer and make your separate chips, your die is out of it. And so it just completely makes sense that if you wanted to have have a chip that were equivalent to two die, then you would just put them next to each other and you wouldn't cut it, right? I mean, it's completely the right way to do it. So yeah, they're not doing anything super fancy there. That's just
the way. No, I want to see if I can find a picture of last year's chip. To back up what Jaime was saying, because I remember, you know what I mean, Jaime, it was like two chips together, right? And they had that one sort of bus in the middle.
Yeah, like I think you described it quite well, where it seemed like they could just cut it there like a graham cracker. They just break them in half at the factory and toss them in one pile versus another pile, right?
But that's what I'm saying is they all start out that way, and it's just a matter of when we're cutting this thing up, how do we cut it up? Do we want to make single die maxes, or do we want to make double die ultras?
Yeah, right. Yeah, right? Yeah. It's just, exactly. Yeah.
And if they're smart, if they were planning ahead, then they would have accounted for that when they started. So
I remember. Here's a question I have for you, because I mean, when I started, you know, was in the reseller days, I had heard once that the difference between a 486 and a 386 was just the performance of the chip, right? Like they would make a bunch of them and then they would test them. And
well, between a 386 and the 486, I don't think
so. Or is a 486X and a 486 plane or whatever?
Yeah, like, that's for sure true. That's for sure true. We used to do that all the time. Everybody did that, where you'd have, whenever you manufacture anything, right, you get a distribution of variables, right?
Performances, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, because... With a transistor, let's say, the amount of oxide thickness, you know, changes the performance an enormous amount, even if it's just an incredibly small variation. And just normal manufacturing statistics gives you a certain variation in any of these parameters. So you get a certain variation in the performance. And it can be quite wide, you know, it can be 40-50%. You know, just in standard, even with very tight manufacturing controls. So you know, one thing you could do if you wanted to is like you could say, okay, we're only taking the ones at the peak and some tolerance around the peak, and that's what we get, and we just ship those and we throw away everything else. But you know, that's not cost efficient, because now what do you do with all the ones? And you have some that are much faster, you have some that are much slower. So another thing you could do is you could say, all right, well, instead of centering it around the peak, we could say, okay, we're gonna take the ones that are a certain percentage lower than the peak and all the ones that are a certain percentage higher than the peak and sell those as the slower version and the faster version, and then you have the standard version.
Yeah. Or you have these chips go to Apple and these chips go to Dell, right?
No, they probably wouldn't do that, because the circuit performance will depend on the chip performance pretty significantly. So you have to, if you have to say this chip that we're shipping you has a different spec with some tolerance. So you wouldn't just send them to Apple unless you gave Apple a guarantee that they're going to be at this faster level and you get the, you know, the higher performance chip. I mean, yeah, you could choose to only send the high performance ones to Apple. That's true. But more typically it would be like, the, you know, 486X or 486 standard, like you were saying, where it would be very clear that this is a different product than this one, and it has a certain set of specs, and it has a certain design window around that performance that when you build your circuit, you design around that window.
Sure. Cool.
Yep.
All right. Well, should we move on? So today they announced this new, Jaime's favorite one and done HomePod, the original, the OG HomePod. They've come out with a version 2 of that. I don't know if you guys saw that today.
Yeah.
Did you have a look? So interesting. It looks, it's got the top sort of little color screen on top, like the minis do, right? And you know, as somebody joked today that they were going to cancel the mini, but they haven't. And these work in the same way. We can make a stereo pair, and they have more better computational audio. Is it computational audio? Is that what they call it?
Yep.
And you know, much more. We thought that they were done with this style of HomePod, but it looks like it's obviously not gone forever, right?
I just wonder if
there's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Yeah. Last year, or whenever it was that they supposedly got rid of them, if just the new version wasn't ready yet, and so they delayed it.
That's an interesting theory. Yeah. Because you're right, they did. Did they get rid of them? Yeah. Like we, and they both. These ones also support the intercom thing, and it's a different speaker. So I mean, obviously, I mean, one of the questions that might come across somebody's mind is that, since it looks like the other one, can you make a stereo pair with the original one? And I would say probably not.
Because that was the first thing I thought of, because I have a couple of the old ones and I looked it up and conclusively, no, you cannot match them. It does not work, which kind of sucks.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they're, I mean, they're.
Yep.
Can you make a stereo pair with the minis?
Nope.
You can't. Okay. Nope. And you can't use the minis in con. Yeah. Because I have, like on my HomePod TV, or my TV down here, I have two of the OGs, and then we have what OG up in the kitchen, and then we have a couple of minis throughout the house. So we have the whole intercom thing working and all that kind of stuff, right? And Siri still can't do half the things we ask her to do, but that's another story. You guys ever tried to set timers on your HomePods?
I can barely get my HomePod to not cut out every 30 seconds these days.
Really?
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Yeah. Yeah, radio can be dodgy, but our radio comes through an app called TuneIn, right? TuneIn Radio, yeah. So yeah, it has trouble with, you know, with understanding us. I guess our Canadian accents or something like that.
Yeah, I know. For me, it's just using, you know, Apple Music. Mm-hmm. It'll play for a minute or two and then stop.
And just stop? Yeah, well, sometimes the radio does that too, but music seems to be pretty consistent. Although, like, you got to complain that Carol, I get complaints from my number one user, which is Carol, that when she asks for a specific artist, it'll play like one or two songs by that artist, and then it starts playing stuff that's similar but not the same. You know?
Oh, yeah. That's the algorithm, though, because what you're doing is it's creating a radio station or a channel for your artist.
And they
find things that are similar or that they think you're going to like and buy. Well,
what's interesting is that Google doesn't do that, and Amazon's Echo doesn't do that either. If you ask for a specific artist, it just... that's using Spotify, I guess, right? Mm. Plays that one particular artist, yeah. Hmm. Yeah, I didn't figure out how to get Apple Music working on the, and then I figured out how to, you have to ask to, you know, specifically play, I forget what the magic incantation is, but there is a way to get it to play just one artist for you, which is kind of nice too.
Can you do something like play such and such only?
Well, if you say play Steely Dan, it'll play Steely Dan. If you say play Walter Becker, it'll play Walter Becker and Steely Dan, kind of thing. Yeah, she has some obscure, you know, edge case kind of... Melody Gardot is somebody she listens to. I don't know if you've ever heard her. She's sort of a crooner. But yeah, it has trouble just sticking to the playlist. But I explained to her how to... I figured out how to get the playlist to work. And I said to her, you say it in this order, and then it plays just that one particular artist. Or you can ask for it to play an album, if you know the name of the album, right? So anyway, this is looking good, do you think, Jaime? What do you think? You're the HomePod expert, I guess.
I don't think I will upgrade mine, because mine is working pretty swimmingly for what I ask it to do. But there are some things here that mine doesn't have, that if you're looking to pick up a HomePod for the first time, you might consider, like the temperature and humidity sensor, which are part of the, you know, sort of do automation for your household kind of things. The example that I'm reading right here from the Canadian HomePod site is, with its built-in sensor, HomePod can detect and tell you the temperature and humidity of the room, and you can set it in automation so the blinds close if the temperature hits 25 degrees Celsius, I'm assuming.
Hmm. Well, that's cool, yeah.
Yeah, so that's useful, right? Okay. It's a nice quality of life thing.
I was going to say, I have a $20 alarm clock that does that too. It has humidity and temperature, but it can't open the blinds.
Really? Oh. Huh.
I bet it could if you connected it to like a smart plug, right? And making a matter compatible smart plug.
Yeah.
That's an interesting idea. Yeah, because I have a Nest thermostat, and it doesn't play nice with HomeKit, right? So I have to run a home bridge app to get it. Anyway, so I just bought a Google Home or Alexa, and I use that to manage. I have a door camera that's a Nest door camera as well. You know, because you can't have one standard, right? You know, although I keep Apple, Google, and Amazon keep telling me that they're coming up with one standard, right? So we'll see.
So another thing that seems like a nice quality of life thing that is coming in a future update, and it's unclear from this website if it is only for the newest HomePod or if this will be available for older HomePods, is the HomePod securely listens for smoke and carbon monoxide alarms. If one of these sounds is identified, you'll get a notification on iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch. Which you might be wondering, well, what would you need that for? It's like, well, for one, I may not be in the same sort of building, right? If you're out and about, you might want to know that, hey,
your house is burning down.
Yeah, while you're away. So that's for somebody like me who obviously is not hearing impaired. If you are hearing impaired, this is a nice quality of life thing too, that like you don't have to see the actual blinking lights. You could be off in the kitchen. It's like, hey, yo, your alarm just went off, and it lets you know that quicker. So that's a kind of a cool thing to do.
Yeah, that's
cool. Yeah.
Could also work as like a baby monitor too. I don't know if there's software for that, but right, if it hears the baby crying.
If the baby's getting too humid and hot or whatever?
No.
Sound recognition.
No. This is with the smoke alarm. It's the sound, right?
I'm being facetious, Mark. Yeah. No. I get it. Yeah. That makes perfect sense. Yeah.
I could have sworn I saw Apple Watch commercial just to that effect, Mark. Is this the thing that really exists for the Apple Watch? Like, I think I saw...
Oh, maybe. Okay.
It was like a mother who is hearing impaired and she turns away and the baby starts crying. She gets a little note on her watch to say, hey, it sounds like a baby may be crying. She turns around and helps. Like, I either in a fever dream imagined that such a thing was plausible or maybe saw a commercial at some point like that on TV.
So is the watch itself detecting that? So you have to be in the same room?
I guess. They seem like they were in an open concept kitchen, you know, dining, living room area. And I assume it was using the same kind of tech that the, like the decibel noise testing alarms can give you on the watch.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I have one last new thing for our main part of the show here, and that is just something real quick that I saw. It's almost could be a pick, but you know, I'm a big fan of accessibility and supporting that kind of stuff. And so this is a quick little post from about in Swift UI, if you use localizable strings in your file names then VoiceOver will actually read out that that name. So, for instance, if you have an image here, an example, person.bicycle, then that's what VoiceOver will say. VoiceOver will say person bicycle. But you can also, inside your localizable strings file, if you put a human readable or VoiceOver readable a string for that person.bicycle and make it equal to person on a bicycle, that is what, in fact, VoiceOver will say. That's kind of a nice new addition or discovery that just came out in December, to my mind anyway. So, all right, let's move on to our picks. I have a few. Yeah, this is kind of an interesting one. It's just improved console output, and it's sort of a graphic, I don't know what you call this kind of style, where it's not really words, it's images in terms of how to explain things, but what's cool about this is a little tool that you can do inside of, if you go to your preferences in Xcode, go to themes and click on console, you'll see how you can change the fonts that are available in your system. You can go in and choose the debugger console output prompts and change the color to it's a different color than the standard green that you get with the console. Or you can put in the output and put like change it to an orange font so that when you're at a breakpoint or you're doing a PO or whatever inside the console, you'll see the stuff inside there in a different color rather than all in one color. It makes it a lot more legible and easier to find. So that's kind of a cool little tip. That's from Xcode Tips. And that's my first pick. And my second pick is from Oli Begeman. He has written a piece here on SwiftUI view lifecycles. We've talked about this in the past on the show, in terms of how the view is, you know, created and generated and modified as you use the app. So this is an interesting article. He's built a demo app that runs on iOS or on Mac, and it goes through the different sort of parts that the view plays. And so he talks about how the SwiftUI code creates like a view tree, and then what Chris Idoff is calling a render tree. The view tree is sort of the template for how SwiftUI will build the view, and then the render tree is the actual pieces that it puts into the tree when it's you're running and creating the view based on what's going on. It talks a little bit here about view lifecycles and state and what happens to the state objects and stuff like that when the view gets destroyed. Other little things like how scroll views work. How navigation stacks with, you know, using on appear and on disappear kind of calls as well. So sort of putting some of the technical information into how SwiftUI views work so that, you know, those of us who don't go down that sort of path can get a better idea of how things are working. So Mark, I don't know if you've had a look at this article.
There's some interesting info here that is sort of non-obvious, like, on appear isn't necessarily called when the state is created. It can happen later, but never earlier. So being real clear on that is, and the stats on that is kind of an interesting. Instead, this is an app, right? You can just download this off GitHub, probably. Yeah, you can.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out what his app actually does.
It lays out the screenshots that you see there, like it shows the different views, and as you tap through it, it kind of explains what is happening on it. Like he explains what it's showing you on the screen as it's showing
yeah,
it to you.
Okay. So it's an instructional thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't actually pulled it out and played with it, but yeah, I kind of read through the article and it makes kind of cool, you know, share it with people that I think need to know this kind of stuff. So, or would like to know it.
Mm-hmm.
That's pick number two. Pick number three is a real quick one. Swift UI has added tap location. So now if you're working with an app and you want to capture where on the screen somebody's tapping, there's a tap gesture location, way of accessing that and figure out where somebody's tapping on a screen kind of thing. If you want to capture that, that's cool. It's a quick little article here.
This is a useful thing. This is starting to take Swift UI out of the realm of you can only lay out like lists and grids and things and actually do more freeform designs, which was always the problem with Swift UI from the beginning, that it was hard to do freeform designs. So yeah
very like that one. Cool. And this is another one. My next pick is on it's doing static analysis on iOS. I was, you know, as I joined a new team and coming into it, I'm not really familiar with the code base. I'm not really sure what kind of security testing that is being done on the app. And one of the things that we used to do all the time at the bank was we would do penetration testing before any release to make sure that, you know, we were using safe coding practices and we hadn't left any strings or loose ends in the app. We hadn't done any anything that would jeopardize our users and our app. And you know, if it's something that you're concerned about, there's a free framework called MobSF, and there's an article here I'm linking from Medium on how to use it, how to set it up. And what it does is you create it runs in a on your local machine. You drop either your IPA or your APK if you want to test an Android app, and it will go through and give you a resulting static analysis of what is going on in your app, and it gives you a big report on, you know, kind of different things that can be left open and let you know what the vulnerabilities that you may or may not have in the app. So if you're looking for a sort of DIY penetration test that you can do yourself just to, you know, so you can sleep at night, I recommend this pretty cool. It's a pretty cool app. You create a Docker instance and you run it in Docker on your local machine, and has a little web page you upload the stuff to, and it gives you a report. I ran it on a couple of, let's see if I got a couple of examples here. I did run it on some of my own apps just to be sure, like, you know, like a device tracker or Pi Day Countdown, just to see what was going on in my apps. And it's pretty insightful. I mean, some of the things, I did have a follow-up conversation with Rob Napier, who's another security expert that I've seen talk at in various places, and he does a lot of common sense talk. So maybe I'll link to one of his latest pieces, but he does a lot of common sense stuff. So I asked him about some of the results that came back in our app, in my app and some of the apps that I work with. And he kind of, like, you know, set me straight as to what was important, what wasn't really important. So, but that said, without doing the penetration test yourself, you really don't know where you stand. So kind of a cool little tool that you can run yourself using MobSF. It runs on Android. It does a few more things than it does on Android, or so iOS, but it does run on iOS, which is, will analyze your iOS apps as well.
I mean, it's kind of cool to be able to run these sorts of things yourself as a sort of gut check on a lot of these things. I think there's the, what is that group called? I'm sure it's probably mentioned in our call. You probably should look. Is it WASP? OWASP? Something like that?
OWASP, yeah. OWASP.
Thank you. Whatever their acronym stands for, that is impossible to answer without machines that can search for content live. Regardless, you know, they come out with their like top 10 vulnerabilities, and year to year, they don't really change that much, right? I think sort of every 5 years, every 10 years, you can kind of see them drift, but the sort of basic things that the low-hanging fruit that attackers are looking for, I like having these kinds of tools to, you know, make sure you don't have these kinds of things. Will it protect you against exotic things? Will it protect you against nation-state level kind of attacks? I would say probably not, but your threat model is probably not, you know, I'm the head of state of a nation, and probably more like, you know, I don't want people breaking my app just for giggles or because they're trying to use it to mine crypto or steal credentials or something. So
the reality is, if you're running a financial app or you know you are running a Bitcoin wallet or something like that, you definitely want to spend the money on a proper penetration test. And that's where actual ethical hackers will try and break into your app. They'll try and decompile it. They'll try and look through all this stuff. And this sort of what this app does, or this process does, it goes through it, but it doesn't really go at a deep level. You can actually have people who will do hands-on testing, but you know, the budget for that is like anywhere from, I mean, you might be looking at anywhere from $5,000 to $20,000 per test. So yeah, I mean, this is not going to cost you a nickel, but you know, it's a starting point at least, right? You can start having the conversation with your teams and that kind of stuff. And then as a real-time follow-up, OWASP it's like O and then WASP, like a bug. It's Open Web Application Security Project, and it's been around for, it's obviously there for web as well as for mobile apps as well. And they've come together and they create tools and resources and education on, you know, good coding practices and that kind of stuff. So yeah, if your team is, you know, you can also do education stuff for your team to bring their knowledge, their security knowledge up as well, right? And one more, I've got two more, and this one is called Gitignore. I was setting up a new project the other day, and I was, you know, I have, you know, I tend to go into my Gitignore file for each Xcode project, because you don't need to store the workspace and all your personal preferences and your breakpoints and stuff like that into your GitHub code or your GitHub repository. So, you know, you set up a Gitignore file for that purpose to tell it to what files to ignore. And so I have a standard one that I kind of just drag, you know, I copy it from one previous project to another. But I found this site the other day called gitignore.io. You can go in there, you can tell it what application you're working with, whether it's WordPress or Xcode or Swift or whatever, and it will create a standard based on, you know, work that other people have done, but it'll create you a standard Xcode Gitignore file, for example, that will ignore all the stuff that Xcode sort of puts into your project automatically that, again, doesn't need to be backed up to your and shared to your team. That way you're not going to clobber somebody else's settings and that kind of stuff. So gitignore.io, that's from TopTal. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, and you can combine things too. It's not like you just enter in one. So I did one for just Xcode, and that's it. All right, well, realistically, you're going to use Xcode on macOS and good old .ds underscore store, the bane of my existence. Always forget about that. This is one of those bookmark tools of just, you know, type in what your tool set is, and this will give you, as far as I can tell, a pretty sensible Gitignore, so you can not have the whoops, here's the cleanup for the initial commit of my repo kind of stuff. It even does like Swift Package Manager too.
Yeah, like it won't put my exe user data in there. It won't put, you know, exe checkout. It won't parts of the internal parts of the Xcode project, it won't bother putting in there as well. And if it puts Swift in it, put in more than just Xcode. Yeah, so if you put Swift in, it puts a whole bunch of stuff in it. It'll ignore packages, it'll ignore playground files, you know, it'll ignore Carthage and CocoaPods if you're using those. Actually, it doesn't automatically put them in. It gives you the comments, and then you can uncomment in the lines that you need for that, right? Because you need to put in, obviously, it's not going to be able to dynamically know what CocoaPods you've got in or package or Swift packages you're using. You have to do some manual work, but it is pretty quick at sort of doing that kind of stuff, right? DSIMS doesn't put those in, doesn't put the actual IPA in as well, right? You know, I don't know why you would store that in your work project folder, but, you know, it covers your butt. And my last one, and this might take a bit more time to go through, but I'm curious about Xcode Cloud, and we've talked about Xcode Cloud in the past, and this tutorial came out in December. I went through it the other day because I was curious about it, because I'm, you know, comparing it to like BitRise, which I'm currently using in my working life, and I wanted to see what the difference was with Xcode Cloud. So I grabbed this tutorial here. And it walks you through starting off. This is the project I was talking about that I started up new. It creates this little, it gives you this sample code for this coffee application. And then he goes through set up Xcode or set up Xcode Cloud with this app. And the problem is, in his tutorial, he's called the app Coffee, but you know, you need to give it a unique name. So I put like Coffee Tim Mitra 1234, for example, is how I named it. And what I found was there was a few little areas that it didn't like. Is it? It will archive the app. It'll do the unit tests, and it'll do the UI tests if you have them in your app as well, and a bunch of other things that it can do as well, screenshots and marketing and all that kind of stuff. But and this is based on the Buddy Build thing that we talked about in previous years, right? And it's a slightly different. Buddy Build was a bit easier to set up than Xcode Cloud, is to be honest with you. So you create your repository, you create your project. I did have some problems with some of the naming of my UI tests. Like they wouldn't run locally, and then if they ran locally, they wouldn't run on Xcode Cloud. So I figured out how to go back in, and I, you know, sort of took it one next level, and I created a project with the proper name, and then went through and got it to work properly for me. So it's pretty simple. It's pretty straightforward. It's very similar to Bitrise in that, you know, you set it up, you set it to archive your app. You can set it to push to test flight, which I've done as well. You know, you add your internal testers inside of Xcode Test Flight, or sorry, App Store Connect Test Flight, and then every time you do a commit, or every time you push a commit up to, or push a commit up to the to GitHub, it integrates with your GitHub. The daemon actually takes it, moves it over to Xcode Cloud, builds it, runs the tests for you, archives the app, puts it up to test flight, and pushes the test flight build out to your users, so it's kind of cool, like from an end-to-end point of view. If you were on a relatively small team and you wanted to give it a shot, you know, it's kind of cool. So it is trying to compete with tools like Bitrise and other tools that do that kind of stuff. I don't know if anybody's done like a hand-built one, you know, like I know one of the jobs I worked at previously, they had Jenkins workflow with, you know, Bitbucket and all this other kind of stuff all connected and doing similar things. But yeah, it's kind of a, once you set it up, as Tommy was saying earlier, when we were talking about with Runway, it kind of automates a lot of those sort of everyday processes that you would have to, you don't have to think about it anymore, just kind of do it, right? So it's kind of cool. Have you guys had a chance to look at Xcode Cloud at all?
I have not.
I have not either. Keeping my eye on it though.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And as I think we mentioned, I think until the end of this year, you get 25 hours per month for free. And also when you go into App Store Connect, you can also see your usage of this tool. So just playing around with this tutorial, I probably did like 10 or 15 commits, pretty small code base. I don't think I've used 30 minutes, you know, as an example. And that's playing around with it for like a couple of days, right? So yeah, that's cool. That's the end of my picks, and then we're going to throw over to Jaime for a little bit of levity.
Yeah, this is called How to Professionally Say. It's a website put together by, I saw the name somewhere, Akash Rajpohit. And it has a concept of, here is what you would feel like saying, but this is what you would probably want to say instead to maintain some professionalism. And, you know, we're all human. It can be really tough, but let me give you some examples that I happen to save here. If you feel like saying, you are wasting my time, you might want to consider saying, being respectful of time, let's regroup when more details become available. Or how about, did you even read my email? There's some alternatives. Yeah. You could say reattaching my email to provide further clarity, or perhaps I'll provide an update when I have one. And maybe one of my favorites here, for no particular reason, is that meeting sounds like a waste of my time. Instead of saying that, you should probably say, I'm unable to add value to this meeting, but I would be happy to review the minutes. And it's a nice little website where you can search for this. You can favorite them and filter by your favorites. You can even print the thing and put it on your wall where nobody can see it on camera. You just right, let your eyes sort of roll over to the side and glance to the side and be able to read from your little script. It's cute.
Yeah. So if you want to say I totally forgot about your email, you can say thank you for your patience.
Yes.
Or Or here, how about this one? I couldn't care less. I defer to your judgment on this, as I'm not passionate either way and trust your expertise.
That's funny. I think I tend to say I don't have any strong opinions on that.
So. Yeah. Whatever Android said, I'll go with that, yeah.
You know, it's open source, so you can always contribute your own options on
it. Oh, really? Okay.
Like. Yeah. Nice. Yeah. Looks like he's got like a little JSON structure. Or
now, someone should connect this to ChatGPT and see what they come up with as
true.
When you type in the thing you want to say, if they can translate it to something more office correct.
ChatGPT, tell this jerk to read my stupid emails, but like do it professionally as the prompt.
How about I don't believe you? I'm not confident the information you provided is correct.
You know, I think Mark's on the right path there because he's actually got a right idea. So this, if I were to look at the flaws of this pick that I've chosen here, and that they're fairly generalized, they're not context specific. So what you do need is additional context for, you know, the AI to understand, well, is this person your peer? Are they your superior? Are they technically not in your command hierarchy, but like, they sort of vaguely have influence over this area. Like those are realistic things that that people run into. That it sure would be nice to offload that to the ChatGPTs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's not using like natural language processing in the search, because if you type in a specific word and it's used in either the comment or the question, then it'll find it. But if you try and put something like dances instead of dancing, it won't find it. Too bad.
Pull request accepted, Tim. So you're right. If you put in overcomplicate instead of overcomplicating, it's clear that it's doing exact word search and not word stemming, as I've learned that it's called. Where you take a word and take the alternate forms of it.
Word stemming. I'll have to work that into the title of the show, I guess, right? I guess that's it for another show. So Jaime, if people want to get in touch with you, where would they find you?
I'm on Twitter as @devofthehair.
Are you on Mastodon yet?
I'm not. I am and waiting to see, and longtime listeners of the show know that I pick and choose what I'm early adopter on. So on some topics, I'm like, I'll let y'all, millions of y'all, be the guinea pigs for things like new iOS releases or et cetera. For things that require sort of a critical mass of folks, I'm not going to be an early adopter, and still not an early adopter of Mastodon. I'm sort of seeing which way the wind is blowing as the owner of Twitter runs around chewing cables in the office to see what breaks, as somebody once said, and haven't yet committed to moving to Mastodon. Although I am keeping an eye on things like Ivory, that work in progress app from the Tapbot folks, Tweetbot folks.
Mark, if people want to get in touch with you, where would they find you?
Yeah, markr@smapsoft.com, because I don't put my future in the hands of some insane billionaire.
Maniac, yeah. My name is Timitra, TimMitra. On the Twitter machine is where you'll find me. You can also find me on Instagram, and you can also find me on Mastodon. You can also find me on YouTube with that handle. So yeah, until next time, we'll see you in the future. Bye.
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 This has been another episode of the More Than Just Code podcast. If you want to find out more about the show, you can visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fireside.fm. There you can find a summary and show notes of each episode. We list links to the apps, code, and news that we mentioned on the show. If you like the podcast, tell your friends, leave a comment on the website, or write a review on iTunes. And please recommend us in your favorite podcatcher. All of these things help others find out about the show. We really appreciate your help with spreading the word. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'd love to hear from you, so use the hashtag AskMTJC, and we may mention you on the show. Friends of the show can also join us on the podcast Slack channel. Once again, the podcast Twitter account is @MTJC_podcast. Please consider supporting the show by pledging any amount on patreon.com/MTJC. Every dollar pledged helps a lot. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
So what were you saying about what happened today with the, is it Donald Trump we're talking about? Or no, it's not Donald Trump, the other guy. The other
guy. Trump. Trump is back on.
He's on? What?
Yep.
On Twitter?
Came out today. Yep.
Oh, wow. Mm. Well, I would never know because I've had a Trump filter on my Twitter account since 2016, so.
Well, I don't know how much she's posted, but it's, as of today, he's officially allowed back.
Well, isn't Parlor or whatever, is it called Parlor? Is it supposed to be Parlay, but Parlor?
It was originally supposed to be Parlay, but because a lot of dumb people used it, they changed it to Parlor.
Parlor? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's like the restaurant in the States. It's Pret-a-Manger, but I think you guys say Pret-a-Manger.
Who says that?
You guys familiar with that? How do you say Pret-a-Manger?
Pret-a-Manger. Even with my terrible French accent, I still...
Do you put your little pinky up when you say it?
No.
No, it's just funny because I when I first started working in Chicago, I heard somebody said it once and I went, no, it's Pret-a-Manger, you know?
Yeah, there used to be a restaurant around here called Boulanger. And people would call it Boulangers.
Oh, okay.
Boulangers.
Boulangers?
Yeah, adding an S to the end, of course, where there's no S.
Well, that's true. Like, I've played with that. Like, I call Rogers, like, a Rogers, you know?
Yeah.
Makes it seem much more
good. Tarjay, you know, is the classic.
Less painful.
Classic one.
Tarjay,
right.
Yes.
Tarjay.
Tarjay. Yeah. Well, Tarjay is spelt Tarjay in French as well, en français.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the reason for not going, that would be your reason for not... For switching to Mastodon is that Trump, I'm sure Trump can get on Mastodon if he wanted. I don't see any reason why. I mean, you can block people on Mastodon. That's, I guess that's the side benefit of it. Whereas, you know, you don't have any control over that stuff on the bird site, as they're calling it.
Are you asking me? I don't use any of them.
Yeah.
General. He has no skin in the game.
Yeah, that's true. How quickly you forget.
So have you heard the news that with the Gens, not the Gen Z, but what's after Gen Z now, whatever they're called.
Alphas?
Yeah. The hot new thing now is to get old flip phones because you can take them with you and not have access to social media. And so you're more in the real world. Yeah. This is the new thing.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Crazy. Yeah, I heard there was a new app today that the kids are all getting on, but I didn't get a chance to look it up. You know, Tammy's been saying that. She wants to get a stick and a piece of string and get rid of her smartphones, right? She's got it down pat. I think that was the name of one of her episodes once.
Yeah, I feel like some of that, along with the physical Instagram for Polaroid stuff coming back and vinyl records and etc., feels like some retro, it's hard to call it nostalgia because some of these folks were not alive when these things had their heyday. So it's vicarious nostalgia, I suppose, or perhaps a backlash against being hyper-connected in a digital world where nothing feels real. And here's this tangible thing that you can do something with, or here's this thing that limits all of the sore points that you have, like the, I assume, Nokia phones that they're getting.
Or StarTax, right? Those Motorola ones.
Oh, the very first ones?
The flip phones.
Right? I just got rid of all my flip phones. Hmm. Did it have to be a flip phone or just kind of be like any... Because on it's funny, I noticed on... what was it called? The Last of Us, he was using a Nokia phone at the very beginning of it, right?
Yeah, because I think it opens up in like 2003. So...
Yeah, was it 2003? Is that when the show starts?
Technically, the first scene is 1968, but for Joel, it's 2003, and then stuff happens 20 years later to bring it to 2023. So that would make sense.
What happens in 1968?
Hmm?
What happens in 1968?
They show the scientist talking about the fungus.
Oh,
stuff.
The two guys sitting in the chair.
Yeah, sort of the premise for the show.
Right. Oh, okay. Yeah.
But the good old Nokias, you know, where they've, you know, they're built like a brick, indestructible, and have like a weak battery life, a week long, not weak as in weak and strong, but as in a week long, several days battery life.
Remember there was a trend for a while where cell phones were getting smaller and smaller and smaller, whereas there used to be these ones that were like an inch long and half an inch wide. It was your phone.
Yeah. And you could lose it.
Yeah. A little candy bar or stick of gum kind of phones.
Yeah.
It's really hard to play games on those, though.
Yeah.
But you could.
Or write an email.
Snake game? Yeah. Or write an email, yeah. Or surf the internet, even. Mm-hmm. Yeah, remember, what was it called? The WAP browser? W-A-P? The text-based browser?
No, I don't remember.
Those were the days. I had a friend who used to, like, he used to love his BlackBerry. He could throw it across the room and it would survive, right? Whereas, you know, you throw an iPad 10 feet and it's broken, right? Same guy would throw his iPad out of his car when he got frustrated. But what else is going on? What's been happening in your lives? How's your COVID?
Who's COVID?
It was COVID.
You have COVID? Somebody?
I had it. But
I had it last summer.
It was cold. Yeah. Yep. Well, we went to Ireland. Did I tell you about going to Ireland since we've been talking?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, we ended up getting COVID on the way back. Mm. Yeah. So it was, you know, a couple of us were, you know, not feeling well, but for me it was like sniffles and a bit of sinus pain and a little bit of coughing and that kind of stuff, but it just felt like a cold.
I had a sinus infection for about a week and that was about it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's how I manifest when I have a cold anyway.
Right.
Like, I start in my sinuses and it moves into my throat and then into my chest and then it's gone, right?
I kind of wonder if when I had it, if I also had a cold at the same time that I had COVID and the symptoms were just the cold, not the COVID.
Well, it could be. I mean, it could be that it's suppressing your immune response.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. So, or actually increasing your immune response, right? Because that's what the symptoms are your immune response, right? Yeah. When your nose is running, all that is your immune response. But but it can make you weaker it can make you more susceptible to catching something, and then you get an immune response in response to that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we had to wait for the new booster. I think we can go get it now because it's been, I think we had to wait 6 months or something before we could get it because we had the infection, right?
Mm.
Yeah. It has to do with the efficacy of the vaccine, right?
Mm-hmm. This is the covalent one, which is Omicron.
The new shiny one. Because apparently now the Seattle Kraken variation is the new one, right?
The Kraken version now?
There's a Kraken version now. Carol told me today.
Star Wars droid one, the XBB.1.5. the Xcode, you know, zip archive, like, oh crap, I have 1.3 and then 1.5, okay, got it.
Yeah, that's it, that's the one.
I'm wondering if we're going to be in the US on a yearly cycle and settle into that kind of like the flu shots. So I'm looking at looks like September of 2022 was the most recent one, the bivalent one. And since I've not heard anything coming up for spring or summer, I assume it'll be right around fall.
Hmm. Have you had the fourth booster or whatever it is? Second booster, Jaime?
Hold on. It gets complicated. So since it was Pfizer all the way through, had the first two shots, one of the boosters, although it did not qualify for one of them because I wasn't old enough and didn't have any comorbidities of any sort, pre-existing conditions. So it wasn't until September that I ended up getting the what would have been fourth for me, but fifth possible if, you know, you meet all the right conditions.
Hmm. You've had them all, Mark?
I've had all of them. I've lost track of how many there are by this point, but I've had them all.
Yeah, thankfully our app, we have a health card.
Oh yeah, I can check my wallet. Let's see.
That's exactly what I did. I just went into my Apple Wallet passbook and just double checked my vaccination card.
Yeah, I think I've had four, but I don't know. You can look in the back, right?
Oh, that's interesting. I got a new phone and it didn't migrate my Vex card. I'll have to
import it again.
Yeah,
I think it's all pretty secure. Yeah, it may be recoverable through Apple Health, but I don't recall if that's true or not, or if you have to.
I think you just scan the barcode, right? Yeah. And it puts it back in.
Yeah, should be able to scan the barcode.
Yeah, so I've had four. I'm looking for my fifth one now. So my third booster, the new fancy shiny booster with the Apple logo on it. I mean, if you get two vaccines, can you make like a stereo pair with them?
Yeah. You know, I would be okay with having sets of two of those HomePods if you could connect multiple sets up to make like a surround sound, like 7.1 kind of thing.
You know what I want to do? I have a downloaded copy of, and I don't know if it works or not, but I have a downloaded copy of the quadraphonic version of Dark Side of the Moon.
Yeah.
But I have nothing to listen to it on.
Right. Right.
You know? I guess I could try it on my surround sound stereo, but yeah, I don't know how that is it like 5-in-1 or whatever, but you know, back when that version came out, you had to have 4 speakers, you know, and a quadraphonic stereo. It's like like the people who bought the 3D televisions that don't do anything anymore, right? Like that wasn't a fad.
No, I can't see the barcode yet. Oh crap. It sent me the barcode on my phone. That's not useful. That's not useful at all.
Let me drop it. Airdrop it to your iPad. I airdrop the file to your iPad.
Yeah. Well, I have the text message they sent me with the link in my messages on the Mac, so I can do that.
I think that's kind of cool. I don't know if you've ever done that with 1Password. If you open a QR code on a screen on your Mac, and then you open and you want to do like the 2-factor authentication thing on the same Mac, if you open 1Password, it will find the QR code on one of your open windows without having to navigate to that window. Have you ever tried that?
Say it again.
If you go to a website and they give you a QR code for 2-factor authentication, they say like, here, scan this QR code, right?
Yeah.
And you have the 1Password app on the Mac, the same Mac. You just go to the 1Password, go to the record you want to update, click on 2-factor authentication or, you know, 1-time password, and it will scan all the windows on your Mac to find the QR code without you having to navigate to that QR code.
That's pretty cool.
Super handy. That's a smart bit of engineering, you know, if you think about it. They're just looking at the open windows on the Mac, right? And just navigating. Because, I mean, I don't know what you guys know about Unix environments, but you know, you've always been able to have multiple windows open, and wherever your cursor hovered over to would become the active window, and without bringing it to the front, like we have to do on Mac, right? You could actually type in that screen, like, you know how you can scroll on a screen that's not the frontmost window.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, you could type and interact with that screen on a Unix system without actually bringing that window to the front. So it's kind of the same sort of idea. It's just looking at the window group and finding one that has a QR code that hopefully matches the QR code. Don't open 2 at once. I wonder what would happen if you did that.
Looks like I've had 3 boosters after the initial 2 shots. So I've had 5 shots.
And yeah, that sounds about right. Kind of makes sense. I was under the age limit. So out of 5 possible, I've only had 4.
Yeah. So I had the first 2 a month apart. And the first booster was 6 months after that. Second booster was 6 months after that. Third booster was only 5 months after that. I got it early, I guess. But it's now been 4 months since then. So I'm getting to be due for another one if that's a thing.
Can you come up with one?
I don't know.
Well, you have to wait for the Kraken variation to come out.
Yeah, well, you should be able to get the same one again, right? Just to get a booster.
Oh, to get a top-up. Yeah, yeah. Is what you mean? Yeah. Well, speaking of important things, you got to see Jeff Beck with Johnny Depp.
I did get to see Jeff Beck 2 months before he died. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Eh?
Yeah.
Hmm. Was it a good show?
It was an amazing show. Unbelievable show. I mean, there were no sign he had any medical issues at all. And I guess he didn't at the time.
No, it was a virus, or he had meningitis or something.
Yeah, right? Bacterial. So that just comes on real fast. Yeah. So he was fantastic. I mean, even the Johnny Depp stuff was pretty good. Johnny Depp kind of came out for maybe like a third of the show, maybe a quarter of the show. So he went out, Beck went out there at the beginning, played. It was everything he did was instrumental as usual. And yeah, so he played a good half the show instrumental. Then Johnny Depp came out for, like I said, a third or a quarter. And then Johnny Depp left, and Ben Beck ended the show with like some kind of the standard, you know, stuff that you'd expect.
Big hits,
Well, if you can call them big hits.
Well, Freeway Jam.
Freeway Jam, Because We Ended as Lovers.
Blow by Blow. Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic show. Really sad. Really sad.
Yeah, I think it was one of the times I went to a concert by myself. I can't remember if I got like tickets from an actual scalper. But this is back in 2010. I went and looked it up because I still have the T-shirt, right? And and I have ticket stub or whatever. But it was Eric Clapton and Jeff Beck, right? So, and they didn't play in the Yardbirds at the same time because Clapton left the Yardbirds, and then Jeff Beck joined after him. But
So I think I missed the first bunch of songs because that was Jeff Beck's set, and then Eric Clapton came out and did a bunch. And I that's one of the first times I actually recorded anything with my iPhone, because I actually have some of the music on video on my phone, but then I also used the voice memo app to record a couple of songs. And then the two of them came out and played a couple of Yardbird songs together. Right? Yeah, so it was kind of cool. They did Shape of Things, and but like, you know, Clapton did like, you know, what's the Heaven song? If I See You,
Tears in Heaven.
Tears in Heaven, yeah. And he did I Shot the Sheriff, which I had the 45 of that when I was a kid. And a bunch of the sort of unplugged blue stuff that he does. So yeah, it was really, really cool. And, you know, like, I was sitting on the opposite end of the arena from him. Like, it was at Scotiabank Arena, and I couldn't be further away from the stage if I tried, and it was still an amazing show. Yeah. So I can say I got to see Jeff Beck, because my favorite album by Jeff Beck is the Jan Hammer Group album, the live.
Oh,
album.
Really?
Yeah. That's my favorite. Oh, that and Truth. I like Truth.
Truth is, very yeah, first solo. It is. Well, Truth and Blow by Blow, I think, are his best, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I think I have all of those too. And yeah, I mean, even though Rod Stewart is a singer, I mean, it still sounds good.
No,
right?
Rod Stewart was a great blues singer. I mean, he got all.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I totally get that. But yeah, I think he kind of went over the deep end in the 2000s or the 90s, I guess.
Yeah, right? Yeah. But yeah, before he was big, he was great.
Some of the stuff that he did with Ron Wood on Small Faces.
Yeah, Small Faces. Yeah.
Like his version of Maybe I'm Amazed, or their version of Maybe I'm Amazed, and a couple of Faces songs that they did, which are really good too. There's a BBC, they did a show at BBC back in the day, and it's probably one of the best live performances of that group, you know, including that cover of McCartney cover.
Wow. For future reference, don't try to upload an iPhone photo to Slack. Because it's spinning and spinning and spinning.
Oh.
Maybe my network is just slow, I guess. But
yeah, I upload images to my phone all the time. Huh. To Slack. In fact, the images I sent you guys yesterday were from my phone.
Saying I'm on Wi-Fi. I don't know why it's taking so long.
I guess it depends on... Are you doing like a screenshot or?
I don't know. It was a picture I took with the camera.
Yeah. Okay. So those sometimes end up in that. I forget the other format that they use that is
HEIC. Like JPEG. Yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes it seems like Slack, whatever process it's using to deal with those, hangs every once in a while. Not consistently. Hmm. It's not an every time thing, but it just sort of randomly decides whatever, or maybe it's iOS that's got something that breaks every once in a while in handling that.
Yeah. Well, I can cancel and try again. Or AirDrop it to my laptop and see how that works. Yeah, that was like instantaneous. Okay, so let me try to... I mean, that was like literally just like less than a second. So it's definitely... And now let me bring it into Slack on the Mac. And it definitely is an HEIC file. Okay, Slack says it's processing uploaded file. Oh, and that took no time. Oh, but I haven't tried to send it yet. I'm going to try to send it. Okay.
Oh, look, there's an image coming from Mark. Kami, what do you know?
Yeah, see, so...
Oh, you had good save.
Wow. Did you do the exact same process that you tried to do before?
So the first time, I did it directly from my phone, just sharing to Slack.
Yeah.
The second time, I AirDropped to my desktop and then just drag and dropped it into Slack on my desktop. And it took like no time at all on the desktop. Weird.
Wow. So you're sitting pretty close to the stage?
Not as close as it looks, actually. This is just how good the iPhone is. Yeah. But yeah. I was reasonably close. I was maybe 15 rows out.
Yeah.
But yeah, it looks like I'm right there behind the monitor.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it is a bit fuzzy, but yeah, it's a good shot. Is he wearing glasses?
No, I don't think so.
Like an old guy?
Yeah.
Just a shadow, I guess?
I don't think so.
Cool.
I have other pictures. Let me check. I need to have my glasses to see, of course. Oh, maybe he is. Hmm. Yeah, I think he is, actually. All right, let me try this one. I'll do the same procedure.
This is great podcast stuff.
Yeah.
Should we sign off and stop recording? Yeah, let's do that. I'm going to stop recording.
Okay.
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. Instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress manicure and Press-On falsies.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.